I'd like to introduce today's first presenter, Mitch Henderson. Mitch, you now have the floor.
Hi, my name is Mitch Henderson. I'm a solutions engineer here at DataStax. And also with me is...
Hi, I'm Ben Lackey. I'm a partner architect with DataStax and work on our cloud provisioning.
All right, so some general housekeeping. If you have any questions throughout this presentation, please let us know. Also, if you stay with us till the end, we'll give you instructions on how you can sign up for a raffle for a free Microsoft Band. So what we're going to be doing today is giving you a general overview of DataStax, what it provides, what it can do for you, and we'll also give you some information about the architecture and how it does what it does and what it can do for it, and how it does what it does for you, excuse me. We're also going to be doing a demo that shows off some of the features and functionalities inside of DataStax. So just to give you an overview of where DataStax lives, in 2003, Eric Schmidt said that it took until the dawn of humanity, until 2003, to create 5 exabytes of data. In 2013, we were doing that every 2 days. Today, we're doing that every 10 minutes. So just to give you an idea of what that means, we're creating more data over time than we ever have before. And to put that in a better context of in the database market, you know, in the 1970s, we started with these big mainframe systems. They were great for the time. They let you store data in a very organized fashion. Around 1990, IBM and Oracle came in with their relational databases that allowed us to scale data even higher and keep our data better organized and allow much more efficient access to that data. Well, in 2016, things have sort of changed a little bit. We're creating more data. We need to access that data more often and faster, as well as have it be far more reliable. And that's where NoSQL really comes into play. And to give you an idea of some of the other NoSQL players in the market, we have people like Hortonworks and Cloudera, as well as MongoDB and Amazon Dynamo. And to give you more context on that, DataStax lives in the post-relational transactional market. So we are a transactional database with some other features and functionality on there to make your data layer a little bit easier to use. You'll notice on there that we are not a fully analytical platform, but we do have analytical ability inside of the platform. So we like to say we're the database for the cloud applications. And to give you a little context on where that fits into the modern architecture, this is sort of a layout of your current generalized web app. You have a web app that people log into and use, talking to a queue, and then that goes into some sort of ingest layer with an operational data store on the far end. And that works well until you need things like enterprise search functionality. So what you do is you then bolt on something like Solr. And that works great for a while until you realize that you need to do something like recommendation engines or deep analytics on that data. So you bolt on Hadoop or some other analytical platform. And that gives you more functionality, but it also comes at the price of operational issues and problems with managing all of those machines. So then you also realize that you need streaming analytics. So you bolt on Spark Streaming. And Spark Streaming allows you to do things like on-the-fly analytics and reactions to what the actual users are doing. So just to give you an idea of what that actually looks like in the real world, this is an IBM DB2 reference architecture. Picking on IBM here because they have a very nice slide for showing what this means. And each one of those boxes on there are a different set of machines doing different jobs and creating different tasks. They're also a different set of machines that each operational group will have to maintain and manage. You also have a problem of an explosion of vendors. So in this space, you have a multitude of vendors that are all doing some similar things. Maybe there's a little overlap, sometimes there's not. But these are all vendor relationships that you have to manage. So if we go back to our modern application, you can imagine sort of all of the things that you have to manage and operationalize and keep track of in your current data center. Well, DataStax fixes that for you. This is the same reference architecture with a DataStax platform. So you'll notice that it's much simpler. Each one of those orange dots is essentially a single node inside of DataStax. This node can be run in analytical mode, doing streaming analytics, batch analytics, or real-time queries. And we can do real-time queries with things like not only Cassandra, but also with DSE Search powered by Solr. So Cassandra is the fundamental underpinnings of everything that DataStax does. It's a masterless architecture that is in a distributed self-healing mesh. This means that we don't have a single point of failure, and we also get some other features and functionality out of that I'll go into in just a second. The biggest one we get out of that, or one of the bigger ones that we get out of that, is the ability to truly linear scale. So if you're running 100,000 transactions per second today on 4 nodes, add another 4 nodes and you're at 200,000 transactions per second. And this goes on and on until basically infinity. The other thing we can do, because we're a distributed database, is we can have truly active geo-replication with multiple data centers, and we can have these be spread out across the globe in 10, 12 data centers if you'd like. And this allows us to bring data closer to where your users are to reduce latencies. We can also do nice things like have an on-premise data center or a cloud data center, or combine and mix up that to whatever we need. So if you have periods of the year where you need to scale out and you don't want to keep that on-premise hardware there all the time, we can burst into the cloud. We can also do things like have a very hybrid layout with 2 data centers in Azure and 2 data centers on-prem. This allows us for an extreme amount of high availability as well as linear scalability with the cloud data centers. Because cloud allows for flexibility, it allows us to have those data centers in the cloud handle more load than our normal on-premise data center. It also allows us to move around with the cloud and put those data centers closer to where the users are for lower latencies. So just some of the benefits of running DSE in Azure. It allows us to have a truly geographically distributed network and distributed data layer of your application. It also allows us to span private and public clouds. So if you have on-prem, again, you can have on-prem and Azure in the cloud. It also allows us to be pretty operationally simple. You don't have to manage those machines any longer. They're just there and you're running data stacks on top of them. So what's in the data stacks platform? Inside of the data stacks platform is all based on and underpinned by Cassandra. Cassandra is sort of the heart of everything that we do here. Now on top of that, we've also built in streaming analytics in the form of Spark Streaming, as well as indexing and search in the form of DSE Search powered by Solr. This allows for a real-time, truly linear scalable DSE Search implementation. We also have batch analytics in the form of Spark. And recently announced, we also have Graph as part of the platform. So that allows us to have a truly multi-model database platform and data storage platform. In addition to that, we have some other value adds, such as security in the form of transparent data encryption at rest, as well as in-memory functionality for those queries that need to have a very consistent SLA. The security functionality also allows us to plug into your existing enterprise infrastructure in the form of Active Directory, LDAP, or Kerberos for those authentication needs. We also provide expert support, so if you have a problem, you can always call in and have that issue resolved. So DSE Graph is one of the most recently announced products, and it will fill a really need for those complex queries that are more about the relationships between the entities instead of just querying the entities themselves. Now, DataStax also provides an enterprise analytics platform in the form of Spark. Our Spark is a little different than normal Spark. We run Spark on top of Cassandra, which allows you to not have to ETL out your data to other machines or other processes. We simply run that analytics right where your data lives. So the network no longer is a problem or a bottleneck. We also have DataStax Enterprise Search powered by Solr. Now this allows for real-time search, and we'll get into how this actually functions in just a little bit. We also provide a single pane of glass management and monitoring interface. This is a customized interface that allows you to manage and monitor a distributed database platform from a single pane of glass so that you don't have to customize or come up with something on your own. So just to give you an idea of where DataStax lives, or where DataStax is sort of positioned in the market, we're in the upper right-hand corner of the Gartner Magic Quadrant for ODBMSs. Up in the top, you have Microsoft and people like Oracle also, and we are right there with them. So just a brief overview of the architecture of Cassandra. The question always comes up is, how are you always on and how do you never go down? Well, we do that through the ability to have best-in-class replication. Because we are a distributed database, we need to have replication built in, and it's truly built in at the fundamental level of Cassandra. That means we can peer-to-peer replicate and keep as many copies or as few copies as you require for your HA needs or failover needs. And this is all transparent to the user. So we utilize the same replication technology to do geo-replication as well as replication inside of the same data center. And this also brings up the question of how that we can manage all of these consistency levels, or consistency among all of the nodes. And we'll get into that a little bit later also, because that's sort of a deeper topic. So this replication also gives us the ability to lose nodes. In a truly distributed platform, losing nodes is something that you have to deal with, and Cassandra handles that very, very well. It's transparent to most users, so if a node dies, we accept it and work around it, and it's built into Cassandra so that you don't have to build that into your application. So this replication also allows us to have that truly linear scalability and allows you to scale up your data center as required. So if you add new nodes, that data is automatically replicated to those new nodes. So just to give you an idea of what a multi-data center DataStax installation looks like, this is Cassandra with 8 nodes in each data center. Now these data centers are a logical construct. They're not true. They don't have to be truly geo-replicated. They can be internal, and we do this for many reasons. Say if you want to have 2 application stacks running in an active-active fashion in the same data center, or you just want to workload isolate and have some applications hit the left or data center 1 and some applications hit data center 2 without affecting the other. That's how you would do this. So what happens when you write to one Cassandra node? What happens is the driver elects a single node to be the coordinator for that particular operation. Now, there's nothing special about this node. He is simply the coordinator for that operation. We can utilize any of the nodes for the coordinating node. Again, he's just for that operation. So in this case, the driver will elect a single coordinator, and he will tell that coordinator, I want to write a piece of data to the database. So that coordinating node will hash the primary key and decide where on the token ring that data is to live. Data centers primarily defined by a single token range that is an infinite or a very large number, and that's that hash that corresponds to the primary key also corresponds to places on that token ring. So in this case, you have node 80 acting as the coordinator, and that node will then distribute the data to node 70, node 60, and node 50. So we call this replication factors, how many times that we keep a copy of your data. Now, in this particular instance, we're keeping the same number of copies in both data centers, but that's not a hard requirement. You can have multiple data centers with different replication factors. So as that node 80, acting as coordinator, is writing to the local data center, he will also elect a coordinator in all of the remote data centers. And that coordinating node in the remote data centers will also distribute that data center locally to its nodes, so that you're only transferring one copy of that data over the WAN or over some other limited link. Now we have the ability to set what we call a consistency level on all of these transactions so that we can define when we consider this transaction a successful operation. And we can do that inner data center as well as in between or for each data center. And we'll cover that a little bit later. So the read and write path for Cassandra is fairly simple. We write to a memory table first, as well as a commit log. Commit log is simply an append-only structure on disk that allows us to have very quick writes. After the memory table is to a certain point or after a certain period, we then flush that to a more permanent data structure on disk. We call it SS table. So now we're going to get into more of the hands-on or demo portion of this. And first we'll need to pull up the lab instructions at the URL on the screen. It's github.com/Mitchell-H/DataStax Superhuman Lab. So what we're going to do is you'll simply go to this web page. Now, the first instructions here are fairly simple and they seem pretty easy. So what we'll do is we'll simply SSH into one of our nodes. So in this case, I am on node 3 in my 3-node cluster. And then we'll edit via VI this etsy default DSE file. And I'll throw that URL back up on the screen in case anybody missed it, and make sure that it's displayed the entire time. So what we're doing here is we're enabling Solr, which is our DataStax search functionality, as well as enabling Spark, which is our analytics functionality. Now in yours, you'll probably see something more like zeros in front of these. To enable them, we'll simply change those to one and save the file. After that, we'll restart our DSE nodes. And the functionality will be enabled.
Now, so, Mitch, a couple comments here, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
So last time, we spun up clusters using the Azure Marketplace. And by default, both the Spark and the Solr configuration are off. And the reason for that is there is an overhead to having those running. However, for the exercises Mitch is about to take you through, we're going to demonstrate those additional features and incur that cost of running the additional components.
Absolutely. Yes, Ben is correct there. The search functionality does require some additional resources, but it does enable a bit of functionality that is required for most modern applications. So if you wanted to do things like faceted searching or fuzzy text searching on your data in real time, that's where the search functionality comes into play. Now, you'll also need to do this on all of your nodes. I believe you have a 3-node cluster spun up already, so you'll need to do that same operation on all 3 nodes. So in my case, I would go into my other nodes. Let's see, default to VID. And change these zeros, or what should be zeros, to ones. Now, through the movie magic, I've already done this so that I don't have to do it again, but I will talk a little bit more so that you have time to do this.
Well, and Mitch, one more thing as our audience works through setting that up, we have a question.
Absolutely.
So it's with regards to geo-replication, how we handle that. So if you have one data center in West and one in East, how do we keep everything in sync and replicate between those two geographies?
Absolutely. So if we go back to the slides showing multiple data centers, you sort of get an idea of how we do this. What happens is that same coordinating node that we're doing, that the right and east, will also elect a coordinator in the coordinating node out of the data center of West. And at the same time, these asynchronously write to both data centers. Now, through a process we call consistency level, we decide on when we consider that a successful write. We don't have to wait for both data centers to write. We can simply wait for a specified number of nodes out of the east data center to acknowledge the write or acknowledge the read, or we can wait for both data centers to have strong consistency and have all of the nodes written to.
Makes sense. What happens if you have a greater number of data centers, say 3?
So if we have 3 data centers, we can also extend that consistency level concept out to all 3 data centers. Now what will happen here is instead of just electing a coordinating node out of the east data center, it would elect a coordinating node out of the east data center as well as that 3rd data center or 4th or 5th or 6th data center, and would send one copy of that data to each of those data centers and would write that data to that data center. Or that coordinating node in that data center would write the data.
Great.
We would also wait for the consistency level, or we are allowed to wait for the consistency level of that data center also. So I'm going to assume that you've already enabled Spark and Solr in all of your nodes now. We're also going to load up some demo data. So while this does look like a rather hefty command, basically what you're doing is you're downloading a small shell script that will pull down some demo data so we have something to work with. We're going to pull down that shell script and then run our bash so that we have that data loaded into DataStax. Something like that. Load demo data. Now this might take a while because it's going to also install a few packages, such as our Python drivers, as well as download a small sample data set that we'll need to have something to work with.
So Mitch, one quick question about that. What's in the data set? What kind of data set is it?
So the data set holds some clickstream data from Amazon, mm-hmm. as well as some product listings from Amazon, as well as some things that people have bought from Amazon. Now these are not complex data sets, but it gives you an idea of what actually people are doing with DataStax and what sort of data that can be stored in DataStax.
So this is a fairly typical sort of use case for DataStax?
Absolutely. So DataStax really excels at the interactive applications. Not to say that we can't be a back-end data store, but the use cases for DataStax really come down to data that has timeliness value. Does that data need to be there? Does it need to be there very rapidly? And does it truly always need to be there? One of the things that sets DataStax apart is that we never go down. We don't talk about 5 nines or 6 nines in our uptimes. We are truly 100% always on database. And when we say always on, we also mean always fast. A latency or a SLA time of 50 milliseconds is a common latency or SLA for many of our users. All right. So we're going to load the data. And then while that's taking place, we can also switch over to a different screen. Going to log back into one of my nodes here. And we're going to look at CQLSH. CQLSH is our interactive REPL. If you've used a database REPL before, this will be very familiar to you. It also has most of the same commands as what you're probably used to in a normal database REPL. So we can see that we have a few key spaces. And what key spaces are, switch back to my slides here. Just to give a brief overview of the data model of Cassandra. The data model is based around key spaces. Key spaces are a top-level container. They're also called schema families or databases and other databases. Under that, we have column families or tables, and then rows followed by columns, and collections or UDTs. So this is an example Cassandra schema. Now, it looks probably familiar to most people. It's the same sort of data types and column names as you're probably used to coming from other databases. But what sets Cassandra apart is our focus on the primary key. Now, the primary key for us is a very important item. It decides how we distribute data as well as how we look up that data. So in this case, we have a few options for how our primary keys are going to be described. We have the ability to do, or in option one, we have just simply searching on the date and partitioning our data by the date. We also have the ability to do things like compound primary keys, and that is in example two, which would be channel and followed by date. Now further on, we also have, on that last example, we have an example of a compound primary key with a clustering column. And we'll get into how we use clustering columns in just a second. So in this example, we have a visual representation of how the data is actually laid out inside of the database. So we also have an example here of CQL, which is Cassandra Query Language. It's probably familiar to most people. It looks a lot like SQL, but we simply don't have joins and unions. Now what we're doing here is we have a sample query that is select star from sentiment where date equals and then a date. And that's great and that works well, except for if you wanted to have something like more than one row per day. So this is where the what would happen if you tried to insert into more than one option per day? You would have a simple overwrite. Everything in Cassandra is an upsert, so you have to take this into account when you're doing your data model. So what we simply do is we make a compound primary key, a partition key. We simply add something to make that primary key a little bit more unique. In this case, we're adding channel followed by date to make those rows a little easier. And that allows us to have one entry per day for each channel. Now, that's not really sufficient for most people. What you actually probably need is multiple entries per channel for each day. So in this case, we're looking up a channel, in this case, Facebook, and we're also doing this with a range query of dates greater than 1, 1 of 216. Now what happens here in the read path is we will simply scan down to that channel and then go wide on the rows and scan across the rows. This makes for very fast range queries on inside of DataStax. We can also nest those same clustering columns so that we can have far more unique data and have multiple entries per day. So this usually brings up the question of how is data modeling in DataStax very different? Now, we don't start from a position of how do I look at my data and decide how to write it and logically organize it. We are much more application-driven data modeling. So what we do is we generally sit down with our application developers and say, okay, how is your data laid out? Or how will you be querying your data? And what will your natural primary keys be? What are you giving each of the queries? And what are you expecting to get back? Now, we usually start from the idea of thinking about materialized views, pre-materialized. So we materialize these views at write time. For the DBAs in the audience, you need to get a little bit more friendly with your application developers because you will be working a little bit more closely with them so that you can talk, or you'll need to talk to them so that you can both decide on a data model together. So just to give you an example of what...
Mitch, before we continue, I have another question from the audience.
Absolutely.
So in the previous session, we spun up clusters using the Azure Marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
How can a user connect to one of those nodes, SSH into one of those nodes, to run the commands you've just demonstrated?
Absolutely. So you'll need to have the IPs of your nodes. So if you log into your Azure portals, you'll have a public IP assigned to at least one of the nodes. So once you find that public IP, what you can do is simply SSH into there, and you should have a username of DataStax. DataStax should be the default username, and that's the user that Cassandra is running as. So if you SSH with DataStax at, and then the public IP of that node, you should be able to log in.
Okay. And a user might be able to find the public IP of an individual node by looking at the Ops Center running in there.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So the other thing you can do is you also spun up an Ops Center node. This is a good time to talk about Ops Center and what it provides. Ops Center is our management and monitoring interface. So if you go into Ops Center, you'll be presented with this overview screen. In this case, we only have one cluster running. So this cluster, if we click into that cluster, and this should be your only cluster running, you'll see that you get this wonderful dashboard. Now this dashboard provides statistics on what's happening inside of the DataStax platform. So it gives you things like write latency, read latencies, as well as OS load, and gives you an idea of what's happening. Now, if you drill down into this middle pane, you'll have a section called nodes. Now, these nodes are the nodes that are running. Now, if you hover over one of the nodes, you'll be able to click on that, and it will give you the public IP right there. And that's the IP that you'll SSH into. The other way that you can do this is simply going into the list view instead of the ring view, and again, clicking on a single node, and that will give you the IP to that node and allow you to log into that node. So if I copy and paste this over into a terminal, with DataStax at, and then that public IP, you'll be presented with your standard Linux prompt. And this will allow you to do all of the pre-work, such as loading that sample data set, as well as running CQLSH. Now, it doesn't matter which node you log into, since all of these nodes are in a single data center as well as a single cluster. So when you're logged into one node, you're receiving data and have the ability to get data as well as write data to all of the nodes. All right. So if we go back to our labs, we're going to create an example key space for you, or give you an example key space, something to play with, and give you an idea of how writing schema for DataStax actually works. So if you'll notice, first we're going to create a key space. Now you'll change this key space name to whatever name you like. Choose your first name, try to keep it lowercase, it makes things a little bit easier for later on. But you'll notice this is familiar to most people. However, we have this new option on the end here. It says with replication. Now what this does is this is where we can define how many copies of your data to keep. In this case, we're keeping 3 copies. And since we only have one data center, we're also using simple strategy. Now, in the case of a multi-data center installation, we would change this to network topology, and that would allow us to define each data center and how many copies of our data in each data center we would like to keep. So the takeaway from that is that we control how many copies of the data to keep at the key space level, and we define it when we create the key space schema. We can change that later on, but it does require a little bit of work. Now, from here, we're going to create an example table. So for me, I'm going to create my own key space. Yep. And I've already created it. So switch that over to which one? So I've created a key space. I'm going to use that key space. And then we can describe what tables are in that key space. And right now, I don't have any. So we want to create some. So in my example here, in the instructions, we have this create table statement. The create table statement will allow us to create a table with the following data types and rows. So one of the more interesting features to note here is, in addition to the primary key being based on name as well as time, we also have this order by functionality. Now this allows us to pre-sort the data based on time descending. So when the data is on disk, it's living in time descending. This makes your retrieval of the data much quicker. So if you need to grab the latest data, it's already at the end of the file. It's already organized for you in a very logical fashion. Now after that, we're going to put some data into that same table that we just created. And it's basically, if you've ever used any other database before, this is probably the same way that you've always inserted data. So you're going to have it insert into your key space, your table, with the keys and then the values. Now I've already done this into an example table so that we can skip ahead a little bit. As you can see, I have my table already created, sales. You can see it's already in there. And I've preloaded it with a little bit of data. So that when you go to retrieve the data, you can also do things like adding a predicate on it, such as where name equals mark. I should probably copy and paste because that will be easier. So what we've done there is we've done a added a predicate for where name equals mark and time equals a range scan of greater than 2015, month 2, day 5. And that gives us a few items back of someone named Mark bought a Jimi Hendrix Stratocaster as well as an Apple Watch. So as you can see, inserting data into Cassandra as well as retrieving data is a pretty straightforward operation. Nothing too complex about it. It's something that most people are familiar with and most developers can latch onto fairly quickly. So next we're going to come back and circle back to that consistency level question. Now you have a distributed database with multiple nodes keeping multiple copies of that data out there. So we don't, inside of Cassandra, we have what we call tunable consistency. And that allows us to tune the consistency of how many of those copies of data we retrieve or how many nodes we write to per operation. That allows us to decide the trade-off between speed and consistency level on a per operation basis and allows you to make that trade-off or decide that trade-off for yourself at the application level. Now, the basic levels of consistency are 1, which means that we write or read from one node, whichever, in the case of a read or a write, it's whichever node is fastest before we acknowledge that that transaction took place. Now, this is going to be our fastest consistency level. Obviously, you're dealing only with the fastest node. On the other end of the spectrum, we also have the ability to turn that consistency all the way up to all. That means that all of the nodes that will receive a copy of that data have to acknowledge that the write took place before we call that operation successful. On the read side, we have to read data from all of the nodes, compare it at the coordinator, and then return it to the application before we consider that operation a success.
So, Mitch, a quick question. What are some circumstances where you might use consistency one, consistency quorum, and consistency all?
Absolutely. So one of the other consistency levels that I didn't mention there, it was a middle ground there that most people choose to use. It's our default consistency level of quorum. Quorum is essentially half of the nodes plus one. In a replication vector of 3, where 3 nodes hold the data, 2 of the nodes have to return the same data or write the data before we consider that operation a success. Now that allows us to also work around a node that's down. So if you have your data on 3 nodes and one of those nodes is down, that's okay. We'll simply acknowledge the write happened and catch up that node when it comes back later through another process. Now, as far as use cases for each of the consistency levels, consistency level 1 is for those cases where you just want that operation to take place very, very rapidly. Now, when we say consistency level of 1 and we're writing that data to only one node, we don't mean that the other nodes won't catch up. We're simply, or aren't being having the data written to, we're simply not waiting for them or waiting for that operation to happen. We're going to go with whatever the fastest node returns and let the other nodes catch up when they can. Now, that write will be happening asynchronously. It's again, we're just not waiting for those nodes. Now, an example use case for a consistency level of 1 is something where you just need it to happen and happen fast. Or, on the case of a read, it's more important that you return data than that return data is consistent. Something like serving out an ad. Sometimes it's more important to have that ad just send out something than have that data be the latest, most up-to-date data. As far as a consistency level all, that would be something like a bank transaction. If you needed to make sure that that transaction took place and that you're going to return that the data took place and be consistent across all of your nodes, that's when you would use something like all. Now, the quorum consistency level is that middle ground of speed versus consistency. Statistically, if you're writing to 2 nodes and reading from 2 nodes and making sure that the data is exactly the same on those 2 nodes, you're probably going to get consistent data back, as well as allow you to work around a downed node. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thanks, Mitch.
If you have any other questions, feel free to put them in chat as far as more use cases on when to use each of those consistency levels. So in the lab here, we're going to show off how we can modify the consistency level per operation. So if we go back to our CQLSH shell, What we're doing is we're turning on tracing. So what tracing does is it gives you basically a query plan of what took place inside of the Cassandra data center, inside of the Cassandra cluster, and which nodes it touched and who it talked to, as well as how much time it took. We're also going to turn our consistency level all the way up to all. So if we turn our consistency level up to all, that means we're going to talk to all of the nodes that hold a piece of that data. Now we're also going to use, in this case, the Amazon data set. Now this is the sample data set that I had you load up at the beginning of the lab. So what we're doing here is we have tracing on, so we're going to see how long it took, as well as how many nodes it touched. And we're going to look at what happened here. So as you can see, we retrieved one row back via this search, and we were looking for this number. And below that, we have our tracing activity. So as you can see, we read from various nodes, and these numbers on the far right tell us how long that operation took place. Now, as you can see, they're also somewhat mixed up, and in this case, we have this out-of-whack time in here. Now, this is an asynchronous operation, so these operations are returning the value for how long they took at different points in this operation. So, having talked to three nodes, this operation took 5,843 microseconds. It's important to note that these are in microseconds, not milliseconds or full seconds. So this took a little over 5 milliseconds. Just to compare and contrast that, if we turn our consistency down to 1 and run that same operation, even on this small data set, you can see the advantage of time. We're talking to less nodes. We're returning data after we've talked to less nodes. And you can see the time it took here is far, far less. And then we can also switch this consistency level down to quorum. And run that same query. And it gives you an idea of a little better idea of where we live in each of those consistency levels as far as speed. Now, it's important to note that we can also change these on the fly. So that's one of the things our application developers have to learn to take advantage of, is the ability to switch out consistency levels. You can always just leave this at quorum, but if you have a situation where something needs to be faster or something needs to be more consistent, we have that ability. And for more information on this or any of the topics covered here, we can also go to academy.datastacks.com, and we'll walk you through a far more in-depth, more detailed examples, as well as on how to use consistency level, as well as which consistency level is far more is appropriate for each situation. So if we switch back, or if we go into the next section of the lab, we're going to be talking about DSE Search. Now, DSE Search is powered by Solr on the back end.
So Mitch, quick question about that. At the beginning, I know we went through a config file and changed a couple options.
Absolutely.
This is related to that?
Absolutely. So when you enabled Solr, or you changed Solr_enabled in the netconfig file, from 0 to a 1, you are enabling Solr and enabling DSE Search. So what happened on the back end here is we simply, in the same JVM that Cassandra runs, we enabled the Solr functionality. So Search is very tightly coupled to Cassandra in the DataStax implementation. And we'll show what advantages that gives you here in a second.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So in your traditional search architecture, you have an ETL process that syncs up data between your OLTP database as well as your search cluster. So that means you have to maintain two APIs and manage two different systems, as well as deal with the latency of that ETL process. in DataStax Search, we've eliminated those problems. Our search runs on top of or in the same JVM as Cassandra, and allows us to not have to deal with two different data centers and two different operational services. So it also enables us to have a single API. So one of the things that we sort of glossed over here a little bit was the driver of Cassandra. The driver of Cassandra controls the ability or controls the functionality of having our application know about all of the nodes in our Cassandra cluster. Now, in this case, the driver also allows us to have that ability to talk to our search functionality. So we're using that same API inside of our application. So you don't have to load a third-party product to tap into the functionality. Now, also having our search on top of our existing data store allows us to have automatic inserting into our search indexes in real time or near real time without having to ETL out that data to a separate functionality. So you're not dual writing or worrying about an ETL process dying. It's simply running or being put into both systems at the same time. This also eliminates the split brain problem. So when your search indexes, or you have to worry less about your search indexes going out of sync with your existing data store and possibly returning bad data or data that no longer exists. So what that actually looks like inside of a DataStax node on write time is much like this. So you're talking to a node, or the coordinator's talking to a node, and it's writing the data to Cassandra, as well as creating the Lucene index on the back end for you asynchronously without you having to worry about that process being done. Now, it's important to note here that Cassandra holds your data, Lucene and Solr hold your index. So what happens is when you query the search functionality, we scan down the index that's held in Lucene for what amounts to a Cassandra row. So the document ID that you're traditionally used to in Lucene will correspond to a Cassandra row. So Cassandra holds your data, Lucene holds your search indexes. Now, since we're also using this on top of Cassandra, this allows us to truly linearly scale our search functionality. So if you want to have a 400, 500 node search cluster holding terabytes and terabytes, even petabytes of data, we can accommodate that inside of DataStax Enterprise. This also allows us to have the failover ability and the HA of Cassandra built into Solr without having to manage that on the back end with some other third-party product or some other product to deal with failover of machines and bringing them back up online.
So, Mitch, one quick question. This DSC search thing sounds pretty neat. What can I use it for?
So, the more common use case for this is things like, in a retail environment, a faceted search. So if I have shirts that are black with buttons and have a collar, those are all tags or facets to that single product. So building that out and being able to search on all of the shirts that are black with buttons and a collar would return back not only a single item, but multiple items that all fit that category. And allows you to also weight those facets to be whatever's most important to that user. So if it's more important that I return the examples that have or the products that have a collar, we can weight that higher than the products that don't have a collar but still meet the other criteria.
Makes sense.
The other thing that it provides is the ability to do fuzzy text searching. So because of the way Cassandra partitions up our data via the primary key, we need to have a very well-defined primary key. Solr doesn't have that limitation and allows us to do fuzzy text searching. So in this example, my name is Mitch, but my full name is Mitchell. Now, if I call up a call center, I'm probably going to tell them my name is Mitch. They're probably not going to find me if they're looking for just Mitch. Mitch Stark will return Mitchell.
So would that work for like the search bar in a mobile app?
Exactly. That's where it would really come into play, is when you want to search for, say, book or books, or Mitch or Mitchell. in a mobile app or a website or any of those other things. It also allows us, the DSC search functionality also allows it to do things like type ahead or suggestions based on what you've already put into that same search bar. And you're doing these in real time based on the data in your database. So you're not having to maintain those recommendations. It's simply done for you automatically in a way that you can configure inside of Solr.
Sounds good.
So I will show you sort of, if you're familiar with open source Solr, you've probably seen this same front end. We do still expose the HTTP API for those people that are more comfortable using that or just want to use it for, you know, just seeing what's going on inside of Solr. So for example here, I have those Amazon, or that Amazon data already loaded into Solr. This was part of the data load exercise that was part of the earlier lab. You also, in addition to loading data into Cassandra, you loaded data in, or created the Solr cores, which are those Lucene indexes that you're going to be searching on. So one of the major reasons for using this HTTP API is the ability to have this query builder, utilize this query builder. This query builder allows you to create queries on the fly as well as see results returned on the fly. So in this case, if I want to look at everything with a rank of *5, it'll give us a bunch of results back based on the fuzzy text searching of the rank of anything ending in 5. We can also do things like the ability to search on our Solr also gives us the ability to have secondary indexes that are scalable inside of Cassandra. So by default, Cassandra has a limitation of only having predicates that are based on the primary key. Solr sort of smooths out that rough edge, and allows you to search on non-primary key columns inside of your database. So in this case, the category was not a primary key, but I can still search on it inside of Solr. Oops. Or if I can type. In this case, the category is not a primary key, but I can still search on it inside of Solr in a performant manner. So if we go back to our lab, we're going to work through some examples on how we utilize Solr and how we actually write queries for Solr inside of the CQL interface. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off by creating a core on that table that you created earlier and that key space that you created earlier. So DSE, or DataStax, provides this wonderful DSE tool that will automatically create a Solr core for you. Now this is a very generic Solr core that will basically index all of the columns inside of that data. And we can, if we switch back to our Solr admin interface, we can see what that config looks like. It's inside of your schema, and as you can see, we're indexing everything inside of that table. Now, for the more advanced users, you can go in here and start to tune this and tune it down for less resource utilization. Say, I'm never going to search on, or fuzzy text search, or utilize the Solr functionality on my rank. It's just going to be a static field that I will always know. Now we can remove that field from the Solr indexing to utilize less resources and have more resources dedicated to Cassandra. It also allows us to change around the data types of our Solr columns or columns inside of DataStax or inside of Cassandra for different types of searching inside of Solr. So in the case of geospatial searching, which is another feature and functionality of Solr, we would change these to be the appropriate data types for that functionality. So if we switch back to our shell, you can see that we're at the bash prompt here, and we're going to run this DSC create core command. Now this is going to take a little bit because it's scanning through all of the data held in Cassandra, as well as generating a core or a Lucene index on all of the nodes that have Solr enabled on them. Now, depending on how much data that is, that could be a fairly burdensome operation. But in our case, we don't have too much, so it should return relatively quickly. But just want to let you know that it could take a little bit of time. Now, for the next part of this, we're going to be using the CQLSH interface. Now, this allows us to see that we can add the solar underscore predicate to a SQL query. So we're exposing the solar functionality inside of the same interface that we use for SQL. So I'm going to copy and paste these queries over to SQL, over into my SQLSH window. Now, what we've done there is we've done a fuzzy text searching on the field of name. Now, we've asked it for all of the things that correspond with star, which is all of the things. Now, if we want to actually limit that down, we can do things like this. So we can limit the number of results we get based on all of the names that start with M-A-R-C star. So in this case, we only have two names, but it will return Mark. And that gives us all of the items that Mark purchased from us. And if we want to take that out and extend it just a little bit further, we can add this FQ predicate into our solar query. Now, what that's actually doing is it's looking at not only the name field first, to get all of the items that Mark bought, but then it's subquerying under that for all of the items that match star out, APPL, star. So in this case, Mark bought an Apple Watch and an Apple iPad. So that gives you an idea of sort of the power and functionality that Solr gives you. It gives you the ability to do those fuzzy text searching in real time. Now, if we want to see this in the real world, we can utilize that same Amazon data set that we loaded up earlier, the example data set, and we can see some of the queries that people actually use or actually are doing inside of Solr to give you a better idea of the use cases for Solr. So if we switch over to our Amazon Keyspace, now what we're doing here is we're looking at the metadata for a bunch of items inside of or from Amazon, and we're looking at all of the things that match that have the title of noir under the category of books, and then we're then changing the sorting methodology of that data to be ascending, and we're also limiting it by 10. So what this is doing is basically giving us all of the books that are of that have noir in the title. This is a very common query that you'll see used a lot, especially in the retail space. And then we can also do things like to extend that out and give you an example of a faceted search query. In this example, we're going to be looking at all of the books that have noir in the title, but also have a facet and utilize the faceted field of categories. So we'll return all of the facets and the counts of those facets for our entire data set. So in this case, we have books at 1,120 different facets. So we have many users of our items in that same data set with that, as well as 5 CDs and 3 sports. It gives you an idea of how many items have each tag. And to further extend that, this next query gives you an idea of some of the geospatial ability of Solr. Now, in this case, we're looking for all of the items that are located in this latitude and longitude. So one of the more interesting use cases for this is if I have a user that's looking for books, I only want to show him books that are in inventory in his general vicinity, right? Where he can go and pick those up. So give me all of the books that are within 20 miles of a single point. We've probably all used the same functionality in many of the applications that we're used to using today. So if, as another example, if he or she is looking for a particular type of book from one location, we can give him, and it's out of stock, we can give him or her, you know, we can look for all of the other locations within 20 miles and say, we have that same book at this other location. Would you like to pick it up there? That's some of the more interesting functionality with these geospatial searches. And again, since this is being updated in real time as you put data into your database, they're getting real active data that doesn't have any lag on it. Now, one of the questions that always comes up when people are new to Cassandra is, so there's no joins, right? How do I join two tables, or utilize one table to determine the result set from another table? Well, Cassandra doesn't have that functionality, but Solr does. So in this case, we're doing a real-time Solr join. So we're joining based on the key of ASIN to the key of ASIN in the other table. So what we're doing here is we're utilizing the Amazon.clicks data set to look for all of the things in area code 415 and using that to then filter into the Amazon metadata table and return result sets from that. So as you can see, this is a real-time join inside of Solr using one table to then filter on another table. If you're familiar with SQL, this is much like an SQL inner join. So then we can also combine all of these functionalities into a single query. And what this query is doing is it's utilizing the faceted ability as well as the joining ability of Solr to return a result set that is based on all of those things and limiting it down to only 5 results. Now, if you want to see this in the real world, we have a demo application that utilizes functionality as well as much of the other functionality such as read ahead and recommendations at killervideo.com, and it is linked from the hands-on lab manual. So now we're going to switch it up a little bit and talk about something a little less real-time, but not any, or doesn't have to be, and that is the DSC analytics functionality that's built into the DataStax platform. So what happens, you have all this data sitting out there, and you want to run analytics on it to maybe generate recommendations or just give you an idea of what your users are purchasing. And these are deeper recommendations to give you some insight into what's actually happening. So the way that this works in the DataStax platform is that we simply write the data to Cassandra, and then we run analytics on top of that. So we're not ETLing out your data or pulling your data into some other platform or even a separate machine. We're simply running our analytical queries on top of Cassandra on that same node. Again, eliminating the network as a point of contention or a problem. Now, one of the other things that most operational folks will sort of applaud here is that we do true HA for our Spark master without Zookeeper. So we utilize some of the Cassandra functionality to do master auto failover. And it gives us a degree of HA over some of the open source other products. Now, the way that this looks is that inside of a single node, you'll have a Spark process running. That Spark process will automatically talk to Cassandra and pull data from Cassandra to generate the Spark RDD. Now, the Spark RDD is the basic data unit that Spark utilizes to run analytics. So if we see that, if we actually go to our lab, this becomes a little bit more clear as to the functionality here. Now, for this lab, we're going to be utilizing the Spark SQL REPL so that we have something interactive to play with. Now, this allows us to have SQL inside of Spark and write queries in the SQL language in Spark. So what I can do here is wait for the Spark REPL to come up. And as you'll see, you'll get this wonderful prompt that you can then play around with. So we're not going to do a whole lot with this, but what we're going to first start with is we're going to look at the Amazon data set. So we're going to use the Amazon keyspace, and we're going to do some things like sum up all of the prices from the metadata table inside of Spark. Now, this process will take a little bit because Spark in the backend is figuring out how best to do this. And it's going to give you the status indicator to tell you how far along that process Spark is. While we're waiting for that to be returned, we also provide this wonderful UI that's a little sparse, but it gives you an idea of what's actually happening inside of the Spark. So it's just to give you a brief overview, it's telling you how much memory we have available to Spark, how many cores we have available to Spark, and more importantly, how many worker nodes that we have available to Spark, and what the memory and resource breakdown is, as well as how much is being used. So it will also tell you how many applications we have running. Now this is my Spark SQL context, and it's the Spark Master here is noting that this is an application that is currently connected to the Spark Master and has the ability to run jobs. It also has a completed applications form here that will tell us what applications have recently run and what their resource utilization is, what they used.
So, Mitch, quick question there. Mm-hmm. UI looks neat. How do I access that?
So this is a web-based UI. Just like most other things in DataStax, you simply go to the IP of the Spark Master, and you can find that by running the DSE tool, list JT, and that will give you the job tracker master IP of your Spark cluster. Since Spark runs in sort of a master-slave mm-hmm. architecture, you need to have a master, and this is the master there. So you'll notice that that IP will correspond to this same web page, and you connect to it on port 7080.
Okay, so that's one of the nodes in the DataStax cluster.
Correct.
Spun up earlier.
Yes, this node is elected automatically for you. You don't have to assign it, and if it, for whatever reason, if it fails, it will simply fail over to another node inside of the cluster.
Right.
Yes. In addition to that, we do have a worker UI that will tell you things about what happened to, or list jobs as that are happening inside of that Spark cluster. So in this case, it will also tell you, it will also give you the standard out as well as the standard error for all of those jobs. So this gives you the ability to through a web page, see what's happening inside of your Spark cluster, as well as see what happened in the recent history in your side of your Spark cluster. So if we go back to our Spark SQL REPL, we'll notice that we got a result. And this result took 29.837 seconds. Now, it's important to also note that in a real production environment, your nodes will probably be much better provisioned than my nodes are here. These are rather small nodes. So this should cut down on the amount of time that it takes to run that job. So moving back to our labs, one of the other reasons that we run Spark is the ability to do true joins. Now, this is a feature that a lot of people utilize, especially on the from the BI standpoint. They want to be able to join up multiple tables together in the way that they're probably used to. So if we run that same job here, what that is actually doing is it's joining up the metadata table and the clicks data table and allowing us to filter on that that combined table. So what Spark is going to do on the back end, it's going to basically do a scan of all of both of those tables in parallel, create a sorted RDD for us, and then run a filter on it.
So Mitch, another question. You mentioned BI there. Mm-hmm. could I use this analytics integration here to use Cassandra with Power BI and Tableau?
Absolutely. So Power BI and Tableau both have native Spark connectors now. That allows you to plug Power BI directly into your DataStax cluster and utilize the data on there for business intelligence needs.
Nice.
Yes. In addition to that, Spark also provides a generic ODBC as well as JDBC interface for your more legacy applications. So as you can see, this returned quite a bit of data and allows us to combine that data or combine those two tables to return that data. And if we want to take this a little bit further, we also have the ability to do that same join, but we're also going to group things in a traditional SQL sense. Again, this might take a little bit because it is looking at quite a bit of data across quite a bit of machines, but that progress bar underneath will tell you how long it's or where it's at in its job cycle.
So kind of compared to some of our earlier discussions, I'm sensing something a little different here.
Yeah, so one of the things that is commonly asked is where does Spark live in my application? Mm-hmm. So Spark is not, especially in the Spark SQL context, is not a real-time interactive piece of functionality. It's not something you would throw in front of a user or behind a website to power interactive queries. It's not something you would put behind a search engine, for example. It's more for the deeper analytical queries that you need to have some deeper insight and can be a little are a little less important to have immediate results from. Now, we do have the ability via Spark Streaming, which is another capability inside of Spark, to do these analytics on ingress into your database. So Spark Streaming will live in front of Cassandra, mm-hmm. and as the data is flowing in, we'll micro-batch that data and perform some amount of analytics on that data.
So would that work for a real-time use case hooked up to a message bus?
Absolutely. That's one of the use cases for Spark Streaming is if you're already dropping your data into, say, Event Hub in Azure. Mm-hmm. You can pop that data directly off of Event Hub, run a bit of analytics to it before landing it into your DataStax platform for serving out to your users. And that's a real-time operation. It's going to happen before the data hits Cassandra and hits DataStax, and it will allow you to have that intelligence added to your data before it's served out to your users.
Nice.
Yeah. So as you'll notice in this example, it took a little bit, but we got results back, and it basically did a sum of the price aspects from various predicates. So it sort of gives you an example of some of the features and functionality inside of Spark and what it's used for. Again, just to reiterate, Spark is used for those deeper analytical insights. It's used for things that don't have an immediate timeliness value unless used in the Spark streaming context, but it allows you to write deeper analytical queries on top of your data without having to move it off to a separate system to run those queries. Now, one of the things that is important to note about how all of these products, all of these features and functionalities interact is that we utilize the Cassandra multi-data center functionality to workload isolate some of these workloads off. So you wouldn't want your analytical queries to interrupt your real-time queries. We would simply, what we would do is we would utilize, just to go back to our diagram of how this actually looks and give you a little more context on why this diagram looks this way, we would utilize that Spark Streaming or Batch Analytics data center to make sure that the real-time workload of my application isn't affected by the analytical workload of my batch analytics or streaming analytics workloads.
So, quick question about that. A little earlier you mentioned that solar workloads take more resources. Mm-hmm. If you have these different data centers running different workloads, can you use different kinds of machines to run those?
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons that we utilize the multi-data center functionality, is because then you can tune the nodes in each of those data centers to match the needs of that data center and that workload and whatever functionality you're using there. So for example, if you have a deep analytical query that is looking at a lot of data and is doing some very heavy computations against that data, mm-hmm. you might want to have, you know, D14s or even a D15 in those data centers. But for your more real-time queries that don't have those computational needs, you can scale that down to, say, a D12 or even a D4 if you're depending on your workload.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And then for solar functionality, it requires more RAM, so you can scale that up to meet whatever you need. And then also, we have the ability to tune the number of nodes in each of those data centers. So say I have 100,000 real-time queries per second. I can tune the number of nodes in my real-time data center so that I have more of those nodes and less analytical nodes. And then we can do this across geographies too. And we're not worried about the data being shuffled around. We're utilizing Cassandra for that same functionality. So Cassandra is replicating the data to all of the different data centers. We're just running something else on top of those data centers to get the functionality that we need.
So you could have a mix of logical and geographical data centers.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that we do a lot in the real world. Say you have an on-premise data center that mm-hmm. holds your analytical nodes only. And then you want to serve your real-time queries out of, say, the cloud, say in Azure, where your application stack is already hosted. Sure. So you'll have Cassandra shuffle the data between the two and just let the Spark functionality run in the local data center and then have your real-time workload in the cloud.
Makes sense.
Absolutely. So the other thing that DataStax provides is some pretty simple operational tools. Now, we're not going to go too deep into these because these are more when you've used Cassandra for a little bit and want to know what's happening internally to Cassandra. Node tool is Cassandra's main utility. It tells us what's happening with all of the nodes in our cluster. So if we feed, for example, node tool status, this tells us that we have 6 nodes in our cluster and it's in data center 0. If we had multiple data centers, we'd have multiple data centers listed here, as well as what nodes are in each data center. It also tells us the host ID, as well as how many tokens each host has. Now, tokens come into play on how we divvy up the token ring and how your data is partitioned. And if you want more information about that, feel free to visit academy.datastax.com, and they'll have a deep dive into that. It also tells us what rack we're in. So Cassandra is smart enough to know, to be rack aware, so that you can partition your data up so that not all copies of your data live in a single rack. So you can lose an entire rack. Some of the other tools is the DSE tool. Now the DSE tool allows you to, from a command line, manage a lot of the functionalities that are part of DataStax, as well as see the status of a lot of things. For example, you saw me look up the job tracker IP for Cassandra using the DSE tool. It really provides a single point to look at all of the functionality inside of DataStax. Now, some of the other node tool examples would be node tool TP status. This shows us the things that are happening inside of each thread pool. This is one of those things that your operations people will probably... This is one of those things that as you're load testing and testing out the ability of your cluster to handle the load, this is one of those things that you'll probably utilize a lot. It gives you an idea of what's happening inside of each thread and where it is and what status your cluster is as far as what each operation is doing. So for the DSE tool, this gives us, if we do a DSE tool status, this gives us a one-stop shop view of what each of the nodes is doing. For example, this tells us that this first node is running search and analytics. So it's running Solr and Spark. And then for the second node, it also tells us that this is the master node for our job tracker. This is the Spark master. Now, it also tells us on the second to last column what percentage of the data is stored on that node. Now, it's important to note that your data isn't always going to be evenly distributed across your ring, and that's okay. But as long as they're in approximate closeness, that's an acceptable way. That's just due to the way that we do the primary key hashing. And then we also have a single log file that we utilize to see on each node to see what is happening inside of Cassandra, look for any sort of errors, any sort of repairs or background tasks that are happening. So for this node, we can see that we're flushing out memory tables to our more permanent on-disk format called SS tables. And it's going to give us an idea of how long that took and how much data actually took, or what amount of data actually took place there. And we can also see that same log file or a subset of that log file inside of our OpsCenter interface here. Under the activities tab / event log. This gives us a single pane of glass to go and look for all the logs that are pertinent to, say, a monitoring situation. All right. Switch back here. So just to give you some idea of how to actually get started with DataStax, these are some of your getting started pro tips. You always want to use the appropriate infrastructure. So don't size your nodes too big. Choose the appropriate node size for you, the appropriate instance size. You also want to get your data model correct. So data modeling and infrastructure provisioning is the two most important things when creating a DataStax cluster. Data modeling is one of the more difficult logical leaps for most people, but we do provide the resources to make that an easier transition for you. We also provide a lot of online resources to give you examples of working data models and correct data models inside of Cassandra. Also utilize the DataStax driver. The driver holds a lot of the functionality and traditional functionality that you're probably used to having something else do. So get to know the driver and you'll start to appreciate what all it does for you and your application. Also, utilize good coding patterns. You're dealing with a distributed system here, so get used to using asynchronous queries, as well as prepared statements, and use batches correctly. Batches in Cassandra are not for performance. They're actually for atomic commits across tables. So use them correctly, and you'll have a much better time. And again, size your cluster correctly. Use the correct number of nodes, as well as tune your Java correctly. Don't change the heap settings just because you think it's a fun thing to do. Test them out. Load test your cluster constantly to make sure that you're doing the things that matter to make your application much, much better. So the next steps from here, if you want more information, is a visit academy.datastax.com. Those people on the live webcast, feel free to email Lynn at the email on the screen for a chance to win a free Microsoft band. Now we're going to open it up to Q&A.
Okay. So if you're on the chat, please ask any questions you have. We have a couple so far. So one is related to node density.
Absolutely.
D14 has an 800 gigabyte SSD drive. D13 has a 400 gigabyte. What if I want greater density in my nodes? What do I do?
Absolutely. So what we suggest inside of Azure is to use the premium storage option. So the P30 disks are a great option for this. This allows you to get the node density that you probably require while still utilizing the Azure functionality of premium disk and the speed that provides. We generally suggest for most of the nodes, a node density of somewhere around 1 terabyte to 1.5 terabytes per node. Once you start going up higher than that, it gets a little more difficult, and if you go lower than that, you're probably not utilizing the full potential of each of those nodes. Now, that is also highly dependent on the workload of those nodes, so how many transactions per second, how complex are those transactions, what transactions are actually occurring. So it's something you need to test for yourself on top of your application stack.
Makes sense.
Do we have any more questions?
We do. So one additional question, is the environment going to be available after the session? So in a prerequisite session, we went to the Azure Marketplace, and each individual actually spun up their own environment, which you can run as long as you would like. It's also possible to go to the Marketplace today and spin up your own environment and follow the instructions Mitch has worked through in all those exercises.
Yeah, absolutely. I highly suggest that you spin up your own marketplace environment to test this out and get more familiar with DataStax. We've only really scratched the surface of some of the features and functionality here. One of the more popular things to do is to spin up, say, a 3-node or a 5-node cluster, and actually just knock a machine offline and see that the database still responds and all of your data is still there. It really gives you a better idea of how highly available Cassandra and DataStax really is. If you want to take that one step further, instead of knocking just one node offline, knock 2 nodes offline. Or even better, spin up 2 data centers and knock an entire data center offline. And you can see that your application is still functioning and you're still able to service your users in a rather rapid fashion.
Sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one more.
Right.
So DataStax Enterprise and Cassandra are eventually consistent databases.
Mm-hmm.
Databases many people have traditionally used are strongly consistent in ACID. Can you talk about the differences?
Yeah, so in your traditional database, when you've told it to write something or read something, it's locking that row. So you're always going to have a very strongly consistent data. Now, that works great when you have one database node. Once you start introducing a second database node, utilizing some other replication technology, you've now brought in an eventually consistent model. So during the replication of that, if there's any lag at all, which there always is just due to physics, if you ever had to fail over that database, your consistency is out the window. You're no longer in a consistent model because a write that could have taken place on the master node is now gone or potentially gone from that slave node. So a lot of people choose to ignore this. It's a better idea just to deal with it. So tune that consistency accept that you will be eventually consistent and use a product that really just deals with that and takes that into mind when you're building your applications. So that really ties back into the consistency levels. So setting those correctly so that you can deal with, say, a node going down or an entire data center going down. One of the things that we didn't talk about with that consistency level discussion was that instead of just having the one quorum and all for a single data center, we can also expand that out to a global consistency level. So have each of my data centers meet that consistency level, or have globally as a shared cluster meet that consistency level on a global basis.
Makes sense.
And that allows us to deal with that consistency or inconsistency on a per transaction basis and allows us to take that in mind whenever we're doing something.
Sounds good. Well,
any more questions?
Looks like that was our last question. As Mitch mentioned, if you'd like to enter for a chance to win a Microsoft Band, send an email to Lynn. And thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you all for attending today's event, DataStax on Azure, Hands-On Lab. And a special thank you to both of our presenters. This concludes today's session. You may now disconnect.